Welcome back to the Health Revival Show. Today we are going to dive into a topic that we get asked about commonly, and we see it in our practice commonly, and conventional medicine, you know, it takes them a long time because they're slow, but it's all right.
Yeah.
We're going to give you some tips and tools today and some education so that if you feel this is you, you can take it to your doctor and discuss these things with them. So we are going to dive into endometriosis and adenomyosis, and the latter is a bit less common. You don't hear about it as much, and therefore there's not a lot of information in terms of how do I address this? How do I approach and manage my symptoms? Because I think many women live with it and don't know it because it's just not, at least in my world, I have only heard of this in a handful of cases. Endometriosis is far more common.
Yes. I think endometriosis is almost overdiagnosed because the true diagnosis of it needs to come from a surgery. And I don't think a lot of people get the laparoscopic surgery for it. And any like awful periods and pain all the time, they just like tag as endometriosis. And so I guess I shouldn't say it's overdiagnosed. I think it's sometimes misdiagnosed. Adenomyosis can look a lot like fibroids. Mm. And so that one I think gets missed more often. And there are other ways you can see and quote unquote identify adenomyosis, but it is also one that you truly cannot identify until you actually hysterectomies, because then they can dissect essentially the uterus or the ovaries.
Which is one of the main things that they say is the treatment for it. It's just
a partial hysterectomy.
Yeah.
So we definitely want to go through kind of like different signs and symptoms of these, how they are truly diagnosed, and then what causes them. They have similar root causes and some things that you can do to help manage and or, I don't want to say treat them, but keep symptoms at bay as at most, you know, possible. And then like, when is it time, you know, to consider surgery, to consider birth control? Because I think that these are two examples where birth control is a consideration in these examples. I really try to avoid birth control, but sometimes for quality of life, it's a better option. So. Yeah.
All right, so let's dive in. So we're going to talk about endometriosis first. So this occurs when tissue similar to the endometrial lining, endometrial glands, and endometrial stroma, aka the supportive connective layer, basically grows outside of the uterus. So this is commonly seen in the ovaries, the pelvic wall, in the bowels, or even beyond the pelvis. And I have had a couple of clients who've had to have surgery. We know several people who've had to have surgery, and they go and have to get into multiple parts of the body around the uterus because it's spread so far. And this is why it can respond to hormones, because it can bleed, it can trigger inflammation, and because it is that actual endometrial tissue. And so this tissue, like I mentioned, it responds to hormones, meaning it is hormonally influenced. And so you can make things better or mitigate symptoms, right? If we're able to support detoxification, support balancing things out. With unopposed estrogen or really low progesterone, it's going to worsen that growth of this tissue. And I'm sure we're going to talk about iodine in here as well, because we think about iodine deficiency with abnormal growth in the body too. So we always want to take that into consideration. But this can bleed and it can cause inflammation. So endometriosis sets off a chronic local inflammation. And in some women, it can be systemic. Again, this can go far beyond just the uterus. It can go various parts into the bowels. I know some people have had even parts of their bowels removed because of the endometrial surgery that they had to have done because it had spread so far. And this is also something that we look at immunologically, because the immune system is constantly reacting to this tissue that should not be outside of the uterus, right? Like, this is in a foreign area of the body. This is not normal, and it can form lesions, adhesions, or cysts. Lesions are areas where endometrial-like tissue has implanted and is actively growing outside of the uterus. Lesions can also release signaling molecules that keep the immune system activated. When chronic inflammation causes nearby tissues to stick together, that's when adhesions basically form. And so picture the pelvis as a set of free-moving organs. So you have your intestines, your ovaries, your uterus. They're all meant to glide smoothly. Some expand and contract. We know this all the time, right? Like, think about the time of your month. Think about if you're having a baby, right? Think about when you're having constipation. Things are expanding, contracting all the time, but within endometriosis, inflammation causes fibrin and scar-like tissue to develop. And so organs start to stick to each other. Ovary to the pelvic wall, bowel to the uterus, etc. This restricts movement and creates this sharp pulling or stuck pain. And so what are some of the symptoms that we see with this? Severe menstrual pain, pain with sex or pain with bowel movements, infertility, chronic pelvic pain, and then GI symptoms that mimic irritable bowel syndrome. And so this is not just bad periods. It is systemic inflammatory disease with an immune involvement, and it's almost autoimmune in nature. And like you mentioned before, you know, obviously the gold standard to diagnosis is going to be that laparoscopy, the surgical diagnosis. But many doctors, I think, are picking this up just based upon labs, symptoms, and, you know, and other things, which I think is important because this is really a quality of life issue. And I know several people who I've worked with, and I'm like, you have to go and have your OBGYN really look at this because the things that you're describing are not just irritable bowel. Like, you've done the gut work, we've done stool testing, we're not seeing it here. What we are seeing is extremely high levels of estrogen and low levels of progesterone. Even if you're taking progesterone, you still have either genetic predispositions, right? So we could talk about that as this can play a role in both of these conditions in the body. But we really have to think about addressing, again, if this is a root cause, things are stuck together now. How do we mitigate, you know, the symptoms? And a lot of times that is going to require surgery at the same time that you're also going to support all of the other things in terms of, like I mentioned, either iodine deficiency, progesterone, or estrogen detoxification, because it's debilitating. I mean, I know so many women who they're down and out for like a week. And I'm sure you hear these stories even more than I do, but down and out for a week for their period. And it's like, you can't live your life every 3 weeks taking a week off.
No. And I think the big telltales to me with endometriosis are the pain with sex and the pain with and or after bowel movements. Because if you think about with bowel movements and with obviously sex, like there is an actual object that's irritating an already irritated tissue, right? If there's, it's an inflammatory problem. Is the ultimate problem with endometriosis. And so anything that's going to push against or irritate that inflammatory area is going to make it worse, right? And I think that that's kind of the key piece of endometriosis that can kind of indicate that's what's going on, that you don't see with adenomyosis as much, that you don't see with just like really bad PMS, right? So I think those are the big things that if you haven't had the surgery, but you're having these types of symptoms, The reason that we need surgery to truly diagnose is because the lesions can be so small and deep in the tissue that you can't see them with an MRI or, you know, an ultrasound or anything like that. And imaging often misses those superficial or small lesions. And then you need pathology to confirm tissue type. And so the other thing to understand is that pain level does not correlate with one, how much estrogen there is, or two, how much endometriosis is present. You can have a ton of pain with very minimal disease and vice versa. And so it really depends on the person and how they experience it, which is why you have to treat the person, right? You cannot just treat a condition or what you think is going on. You have to look at the person sitting in front of you and what they're experiencing. So then we have adenomyosis, and we're going to dive into, you know, the kind of same things of what causes it and symptoms and all that stuff. But adenomyosis is more so when the endometrial glands grow into the muscular wall of the uterus. So it's called, known as the myometrium, but with endometriosis, it grows outside of the endometrium, right? So it grows outside, which is why it can affect other organs. With adenomyosis, it grows into the muscular wall. So instead of tissue being in the wrong location entirely, it's growing in the wrong layer of the uterus. Because it grows in that muscular wall. Because of that, it then affects how the muscles contract. And so that is why it drives. One of the main signs of this is when you have debilitating cramps. So a uterus becomes basically enlarged or kind of bogged down, and then you have very heavy bleeding. So I see this a lot of times with people that have really heavy clots and very heavy periods to where like they're losing tons of blood. I think of the stand up and feel the gush. Right? Like that should not be happening. And then intense cramping and then chronic pelvic pressure or fullness. So you just feel like it's very full there, right? It's very swollen. And symptoms tend to overlap with fibroids, which is why it's often missed unless there's MRI or a pathology used to diagnose it. So adenomas is different. There are ways that you can technically diagnose it without surgery. MRI is the most accurate, non-invasive tool because an MRI can basically detect the thickening of the junctional zone. It can detect the glandular tissue inside of the myometrium, and it can also detect changes in the uterine texture and size. That's kind of the big thing that they'll identify with all of these different mechanisms, is that you start to see like asymmetry to the uterus. So you should be able to see evenness on both sides of the uterus. But when the MRI or the ultrasound start to see, basically, it doesn't look smooth and it doesn't look uniform. It starts to look, they call it the Venetian blind shadowing, but it basically is like very streaky and vertical shadow patterns that start to appear on the ultrasound because of the irregular thickening of the muscle fibers. So that is a classic sign that the more normal muscle architecture is kind of disrupted, and that can be seen with this. And then you also lose the normal myometrial pattern, which is that smooth, consistent appearance of the muscles. You'll start to see this dysfunction and kind of blurred, distorted pattern. So the problem with ultrasounds is they are very operator dependent. If you have a really good ultrasound tech and they know what they're looking for and they're doing a good job, you can find something potentially. But if you have someone that like doesn't really have experience with it, then it might not be as definitive. And then there's the definitive pathology after a hysterectomy. So this is truly the only absolute confirmation of adenomyosis is through a microscopic exam of the uterus after it's removed. So clinical pattern recognition, really heavy bleeding and clots, painful labor type cramping. So anyone that's had babies knows that pain and knows that extreme cramp feeling. An enlarged uterus on an exam. So the way I think about it is like a thickened uterus is a lot of times what they say. And then worsening of symptoms in your 30s and 40s tends to be it. So unlike endometriosis, symptoms of adenomyosis often do correlate with the severity of it.
Yeah, one of my clients is 44 and just got diagnosed with this. And again, it's one of those things where, all right, if you're dealing with water retention, you're waking up puffy, your ankles or your wrists are really swollen, or you can't get your rings off, and maybe you're even dragging throughout the day, no matter how much water you drink, there's actually a good chance that you're not actually hydrating properly.
Exactly. Because water alone is not enough. You need electrolytes. You need sodium, potassium, magnesium, because those things actually pull water into your cells. Otherwise, you're basically just flushing it out and wondering why you're still tired, you're still bloated, and you're still sluggish.
But here's the thing. Most electrolyte supplements out there aren't helping you in any way, because a lot of them contain things like natural flavors, food dyes, and maltodextrin, which can irritate your gut. And these things can also spike your blood sugar when you're trying to heal.
That's why we both started using Buoy. It's super simple. There's trace minerals and electrolytes in liquid form. No flavors, no colors, no sugar, no sweeteners. And you squeeze it into whatever you are drinking. Water, coffee, tea, smoothies, you name it.
And it's clinically backed by science too. So studies have shown that Buoy helps you hydrate better, 64% better in fact. And that's data coming from key blood and urinary markers, not just marketing fluff. And honestly, you can feel the difference. I've had many clients tell me their digestion's improved, they have less headaches, and they're better energy throughout the day.
And Buoy isn't just for people that go to the gym all the time and sweat a bunch. They actually offer a 35% lifetime discount for anyone that's struggling with chronic illnesses. Things like POTS, Hashimoto's, Crohn's disease, chronic migraines, and every autoimmune condition. They're really committed to making better hydration accessible to people who need it most.
I actually throw it in my coffee every morning because it's such an easy upgrade. You don't even taste it, but you're definitely going to notice if you miss it.
If you're tired of playing hydration roulette and want something that actually supports your body, you've got to try Buoy. It's honestly one of the simplest ways to feel better faster.
I think unless you are really, really intentionally talking to your doctors and saying like, hey, I am miserable every 28, 30 days, or, you know, have a doctor that's, hey, you know, this sounds like we need to do some further investigation. Most of the time you're getting swept under the rug, see you next month, or just birth control is, you know, your only option. So what are some root cause contributors to both of these? As we've already mentioned, both of these are associated with chronic inflammation, right? So Conditions create and are worsened by inflammatory signals in the body. Inflammation affects our pain perception, our immune function, how your body is able to repair your tissues, and the sensitivity to hormones. And so this is why many women feel systemic symptoms beyond the pelvic region. Because again, this is an immunological response. It's a systemic inflammatory response throughout the body, and this is all disrupting your immune regulation. So research shows differences in our macrophage activity. Macrophages are supposed to clean up abnormal cells. Think about Pac-Man. I always love macrophages. It's my Pac-Man coming in, cleaning up abnormal cells and debris. But in endometriosis, they often become overactive in the wrong way. So they're producing inflammatory signals instead of clearing the misplaced tissue, which creates a cycle where inflammation increases, but the lesions themselves are not effectively removed. It also impacts our natural killer cell function. So these natural killer cells normally help the immune system recognize and eliminate cells that are out of place. They're in the wrong spot. Put it back, right? In endometriosis, the natural killer cell activity can be reduced or altered, meaning the immune system is not as effective at identifying and clearing out the endometrial-like cells that implant where they don't belong. And then lastly, we have a cytokine patterning here. So cytokines are chemical messengers that regulate inflammation. In cytokines, they amplify pain, increase nerve sensitivity, and help lesions survive. So this creates the chronic inflammatory environment rather than a controlled repair response. So this can help explain why the body struggles to clear that misplaced tissue and why flares patterns resemble immune dysfunction. And then number three here is hormonal related factors, not just high estrogen, as we've already mentioned. These have a lot to do with our estrogen metabolism, not just dominance. So metabolism is how we are able to properly detoxify estrogen, which pathway it's flowing down. So when we're thinking about this, we love to see a Dutch test, but we're also thinking about methylation, glucuronidation, sulfation. Do we have the key cofactors and nutrients to support these pathways grabbing on to free radicals in the body, toxins in the body, metabolized hormones, things that have already been used up and helping you eliminate them? Taking them from a fat-soluble compound to a water-soluble compound so that we can pee, poo, and sweat them out. Do we have reactivation in the gut, right? We think a lot about the gut microbiome and beta-glucuronidase enzyme activity that can reactivate hormones that are set for elimination and excretion, but they can reactivate them and send them back to circulation. So even though on paper, whether it's a Dutch test or blood work, we don't see an overtly high level of estrogen, but we see high levels of beta-glucuronidase and then maybe not properly methylating them out or having the cofactors such as NAC, glutathione, various B vitamins, those types of things to eliminate them, then these go into recirculation and you experience the inflammatory response, the immune dysregulation, and this estrogen dominance, you know, feeling. The second thing is, and this is really, really important, poor bile flow. And again, so I already mentioned gut issues that slow estrogen clearance with that beta-glucuronidase, but poor bile flow. So bile should flow fluidly through your small intestine. Some of it's going to stay there, help you absorb your fat soluble vitamins and absorb, you know, nutrients and things like that. But a lot of bile's job is to act as a detergent, to scrub things out, to eliminate things that, you know, we need to get rid of. However, when we have a lot of dysbiosis, we have a lot of inflammation in the liver, non-alcoholic fatty liver even, this can make our bile more stagnant, more peanut butter. We call this biliary stasis, right? Or it can be insufficient that the liver is not producing enough bile and you're not storing and concentrating in the gallbladder. Maybe your gallbladder's been removed. That could play a role here too. And so therefore we don't have enough bile in the right concentration at the right time to clear out all of these toxins and hormones and maintain proper balance in the microbiome. And when that happens, not only are we going to see, you know, more of a picture of inflammation and leaky gut, we're also going to see the lipopolysaccharides that seek out to the bloodstream. Those are endotoxins. They further exacerbate this impaired liver function and bile flow because they cause a lot of inflammation in the liver. And then next is low iodine. So iodine plays a role in how the body processes estrogen. Adequate iodine has been shown to support the production of more protective estrogen metabolites, like 2-hydroxyestrone. It also helps reduce more proliferative metabolites like 16-hydroxyestrone. So we see these on our Dutch test and the clearance of your estradiol, estrone, and estriol. And these pathways really matter because endometriosis is that estrogen responsive condition. So if estrogen detox leans more towards the proliferative pathways, the inflammatory pathways, then we are ending up, you know, in a situation where we are, you know, experiencing this and we're flaring more, we're experiencing more of that pain, maybe again, more of the growth, right? In terms of the cyst or fibroids or that tissue growing.
Yep. So at the end of the day, it's more so not about how much estrogen is present. Honestly, with most of the endometriosis cases I've seen, they don't have high estrogen. They have actually pretty normal estrogen. It's about how their body is processing and receptors are responding to estrogen. Gut health, we kind of already touched on this a little bit. So the gut microbiome, the estrobilome is a big piece of how you are regulating your estrogen recycling via the gut. Dysbiosis in the gut, so imbalances of bacteria can obviously increase inflammation to begin with. And then constipation or slowed motility can worsen estrogen recirculation. And if there's inflammation in that area, we know all the organs in that area are so closely, you know, together that inflammation of an endometrial tissue can bleed over into inflammation of the colon and inflammation of the small intestine because they're all packed in there. And more inflammation can cause worsening of that tissue to be able to let bowels move freely through it. So women with endometriosis especially have higher rates of IBS-like symptoms for this reason. Genetic predisposition. So there is a large genetic factor to these things. A lot of girls who I talk to, women who I talk to that have endometriosis, their moms had endometriosis or had adenomyosis or other types of really bad PMS estrogen-based symptoms. So there is documented heritability in both disorders, and genes involved can relate to the immune response. They can relate to inflammation. They can relate to receptors, hormone receptors. So the big ones that we know of, the CYP1981 gene, this is your aromatase gene. This gene controls how your testosterone converts to estrogens or how your androgens, eicholandrolone and aldosterone, convert to estrogens. And so endometriotic lesions can express abnormally high aromatase activity. And this basically creates local estrogen production inside the lesions. So different tissue in the body can have higher aromatase activity. And it appears that in research, we see higher aromatase activity in these endometrial lesions. CYP1B1. This is phase one enzyme that converts estradiol into 4-OH estrogen, which is a more pro-inflammatory metabolite. And variants can lead to higher production of that 4-OH and greater dependence on antioxidant and methylation pathways. So basically, with this mutation, your body needs more antioxidant and methylation support to neutralize these metabolites. If you do not know that, you aren't taking higher levels of prebiotics. You aren't taking greens powders or sulforaphane or vitamin C or, you know, DIM or all of these different things. Well, your methylation is not going to be very supported and this other pathway is not going to be very supported and they both need extra support. So this can lead to bigger burden on the systems and then in turn, systems start to break and then we start to see the growth, right? COMT is a huge one. So COMT helps clear catechol estrogens, which are the reactive intermediates formed during phase one estrogen metabolism. Phase one estrogen metabolism basically is where estrogens become water soluble to pass through to phase two. But the problem is when that happens, they become kind of like free radicals for a period of time. So the thing that I always imagine is like, imagine a Tasmanian devil's in a box. You undo the box. And for a short period of time, that Tasmanian devil is kind of free in the body, and that's when it needs to be packed up into a different box with a methyl group or a sulfur group or glucuronidation or glutathione. And essentially, if you don't have enough of those things to pack it back up, well, it's going to roam back free into the body and cause all kinds of havoc. And so that's where this COMT, this doesn't necessarily cause endometriosis adenomyosis, but it can contribute to the estrogen inflammatory interaction that makes symptoms worse. And then some other genes that are kind of notable, IL-6 is an inflammatory gene, an immune gene that can cause basically a higher inflammatory baseline in the body. So people with these mutations just kind of run at a higher baseline of inflammation than other people, which obviously if these are inflammatory disorders are going to affect that. TNF-alpha. GSTM1 is a detox gene. So if you have poor detoxification abilities, poor glutathione production, that can impair the ability to detox estrogen. And then SOD2 is an antioxidant gene. So this is something that helps to produce endogenous antioxidants. Our body makes its own antioxidants. And so if you have impairments in that, well, we don't have the reserves needed to kind of battle these things. So again, genetics don't cause conditions, but they can definitely influence susceptibility.
And I think when we're looking at the full picture, we're able to adjust the treatment and the protocol, right, to look at, for example, I'm just thinking of the case we just talked about yesterday. Hey, I see here on the Dutch test that we have problems with the clearance. we don't have an extreme, you know, level of estrogen, but we have a clearance problem. And we also know from a genetic predisposition, she has the COMT and the CY P19A1. And so very clearly between those two tests, this is going to be a situation that person is going to need to supplement long-term with things to help clear things out. Now, the next one is environmental and chemical exposures. So there's a lot of evidence out there talking about the endocrine disrupting chemicals. Think about phthalates, parabens, everything that you're putting on your body that is your personal skincare, hair care products, things you're using in your home. Again, we've like joked about like the Glade plugins or the candles and all those types of things. And many people just think, that's not going to kill me. Nah, it's not, you know, much of a big deal. But when we really start to look at it, especially on the hormone zoomer, some of these endocrine disrupting chemicals, what we see is that they mimic, right? And so they can mimic estrogen in the body, or they can block receptors and cause, you know, issues in terms of your body signaling. And so that's a really important thing to think about. And then we also think about how they impact our immune system, and how if we're unable to detoxify these things, again, going back to maybe I do have a SOD2 mutation, maybe I have things going on in terms of my gut and my mitochondria and my autophagy genes from a genetic perspective too, and I'm unable to clean house appropriately and detoxify appropriately, this is going to burden your body, and it builds up this toxic bucket, and then eventually you spill over and we have this whole cascade of issues, right? So those are things to think about. Again, they're not just on their own, but is part of this whole picture. Then we think about impaired tissue repair. So some research points to abnormalities in how specific tissues repair damage each cycle, allowing displaced cells to implant or invade. And so when we want to come in and we want to think about, I think too, it's important to say in terms of folliculogenesis, right? The life cycle of the follicles, anything with hormones usually takes about 90 days to improve. Mm-hmm. You know, when we're looking at like, hey, we put this in place. Yeah. Maybe that next period, things are a little bit better. Hey, the second cycle, wow, things are even better. By the third, fourth cycle, like I'm thinking about a couple of my clients with like debilitating migraines, bad cramps, some of the things that are not necessarily associated with endo or adenomyosis here, but looking at how they were clearing their estrogen and how they were experiencing in their body, it took us 60, 90, 120 days to really see, man, now I got my period. I have no migraines. I have no cramps. I'm not laid up in bed. I'm not debilitated, right? So just remember that in terms of the life cycle with your, you know, hormones. And also, I think just be patient and recognize that sometimes when you are doing this deeper healing work, it's not like a medication where you start birth control and things, you know, turn around pretty quickly, or you did like a digestive enzyme and wow, I can tell that I'm, you know, absorbing my food better. I don't have as much bloating. Some of this stuff is going to take time as you're peeling back the layers of the onion to really get to some of those underlying causes that are driving this. So how do we support this? What are things that we can do?
Yep. So number one is hormone metabolism and detoxification pathways, because especially endometriosis is very hormonally influenced. You need to make sure that you are breaking down and detoxifying and clearing your hormones properly so they aren't creating a bigger influence than they should be. So this is where we do look at like a DIM, a calcium deglucurate. In some situations, I'm even considering like a low-dose estrogen blocker. So this is what breast cancer patients get prescribed. They take it constantly. You can take it one or two times a week to kind of keep down those levels of estrogen. You don't want to be taking it constantly because that will come with its own risks, but it has been used in some cases successfully for that. Adequate B2. So you need B2 for CYP1A1 activity with aromatization. And if you don't have adequate levels of B2, you can sometimes push way more to your estrogen levels. Magnesium glycinate is a cofactor for COMT. So for COMT to work properly and clear those estrogen catechols, we need to make sure that we have magnesium on board. Then we look at bile flow. So bile flow, gut motility, microbiome status, we need to be pooping daily. We know that our poop is the way that we eliminate hormones. Hormones and fat-soluble toxins like mold and mycotoxins are eliminated via bile and the stool. So if you are not pooping daily, you will not be clearing these things. And when appropriate, bile can worsen things in some people. So if you do a ton of bile to try and be like, oh, more bile, the better, you can actually worsen symptoms for some people. So you need to be careful with bile. Sometimes TUDCA can be a better first step. Other people respond to TUDCA. So it is very case dependent with these things. And I typically encourage working with someone to make sure that you are guided properly in this. You need to address things like SIBO. if someone is symptomatic, SIBO is actually very common in endometriosis patients. And so we need to watch and see all possible drivers of inflammation and GI imbalances, which then are going to influence the immune system and in turn influence endometriosis or adenomyosis. You want to reduce gut wall inflammation. So things like immunolins, zinc L-carnosine, glutamine in certain cases, because if we think of those areas, again, like we talked about, all these organs are so close together. And so if the gut wall is inflamed, it can worsen inflammation in other areas close to it, like the uterus, like the ovaries, like the endometrial tissue. Supporting the estrobilum. So that might be utilizing things like calcium beglucarate. That might be using probiotics that support the estrobilum. So very case dependent on this stuff, but you need to make sure that the gut is in a good spot.
Yeah. When we think about some of these other environmental exposures, as I talked about, thinking through what's in your home, reducing the BPAs, the plastics, the parabens, maybe downloading, you know, a free app, like, you can look at the EWG website, but there are, I have a few of them on my phone. I'm blanking on the names of them right now, but things that you can go and you can scan. Yeah. Like the Yuka app, there's like a toxin free or something like that, too. But looking at that, filtering your drinking water. Guys, we've talked about this 100,000 times. Water is one of your biggest inputs. And we know that if you're not filtering your water, you're drinking tap water, you're getting exposed to all types of contaminants, including birth control, antibiotics, parasites, bacteria, heavy metals. Like the list goes on, and it's absolutely disgusting when you really look at what they're finding. And what I would encourage you to do, if you think that tap water is okay, or someone in your house thinks it's okay, go on to the EWG and put in your zip code and see what your city, you know, municipality is finding according to the EWG, how high. Like we've seen crazy high levels. If you're on a well water, I've seen this firsthand for one of my clients. We were able to fix her thyroid issues just because we were able to clear the heavy metals that were coming from her well water. So that's really important. You want to switch over to clean fragrances. So I love Dime Beauty. It's a clean perfume and cologne. The cologne is phenomenal for men, and even my 6-year-old uses it. So cute. I love their perfume as well. And then thinking about swapping out things in your household. So Truly Free, Beck and I both use that. I also love Topanga scents for my laundry, which I pair with it because I want it to smell really good. So you can still have things that smell good and live a fun life that is low tox. Nutrient status. So as we talked about, like this influences detox, repair, immune balance. Becca went over some of those, but further than this, what are things that deplete you? When you're very heavily stressed, we are getting depleted of magnesium, vitamin C, zinc, boron, sodium, potassium. Sodium, fun fact, is like the last thing to go. Potassium, magnesium, boron, and you know, other things are going to be depleted first. So really thinking about that in terms of where do I need to add more potassium rich foods? Maybe looking at your vitamin D levels and optimizing that. Anywhere between 50 and 70 is where I like to see them. If you have autoimmune, closer to that 70, even 80 marker, looking at other nutrient deficiencies. We've talked about this, iodine, iron, selenium, like all those things that are going to be really important for your thyroid, but also to prohibit growth in the body. And then stress reduction, right? So we know that stress alters our cytokine balance. It throws everything off in the body. And we want to think about reducing stress so that we can reduce stress on the body as well. And so that's where you're going to follow, you know, maybe looking at some of the anti-inflammatory diets. It's going to be looking at things that can support lowering inflammation in the body. If you're looking at your blood work, checking those inflammatory markers, using a good high quality fish oil or Caprex, things that can really be supportive of lowering inflammation and pain. NAC, vitamin C, or ALA have all been shown in research for symptom improvement. And then we can look at maybe some peptides like SS31, thymosin alpha 1. These I would recommend that you are working with a practitioner and knowing when to use them, how to dose them, those types of things, because they can support oxidative stress in the body and regulates more of that T cell activity. Then last but not least here, I would definitely say, you know, addressing some of those mechanical or structural issues. I talk a lot about pooping hygiene. So we talked about pain after bowel movements. Are you getting in the right position? Are you straining? Are you supporting your body in other ways so you don't have to do those things? That would be important. Pelvic floor therapy, critical for pain reduction. Maybe you are finding that you are really, really tight. Maybe you also need to get like a red light wand and do some of that therapy internally. Myofascial release, we know that acupuncture can be beneficial here. Any movement that releases that pelvic congestion. So walking, lymphatic movements, lymphatic massaging, vibration plates, gentle strength training, all of those things can be helpful. And then if you do have adhesions, that's going to be where you really need to think about maybe getting, you know, either surgery or other, you know, things that you can put into place daily to help kind of break those things apart, and regain or get back some of that organ motility.
Yeah. The Joylux is the brand that I really like for the internal red light wand. I have done internal injected BPC intravaginally, holding it there for, you know, 15 minutes if possible, and using like a little, I think of like the syringes that you use for your kids when you give them medicine. You can use that to put BPC intravaginally and then follow it with red light therapy, to address more of like the inflammatory profile. That is something I've done with some of my endometriosis clients. And then in the cases of like a partial hysterectomy and when it's time to visit that, I usually try to go the route of let's support symptoms first. Let's see if we can improve symptomology via detoxification support, inflammatory support. Sometimes fasting can be really helpful to calm down the immune system and the inflammatory pathways. And then if we need to go the route of surgery, can we go and at least begin with just removing the endometrial tissue that has grown, right? The tissue that has grown outside of the endometrium. And can we try to be more preventative on having it grow back? That is always my first option. If for whatever reason we cannot manage the symptoms for the client, I typically go the route of the partial hysterectomy before I go the route of birth control, if I'm being totally honest. Especially because a lot of these people, you can get bleeding under control. You can get a lot of the other symptoms under control. It's more the pain that people experience. And I personally don't find birth control helps with that as much. So just kind of my personal experience working with these clients and seeing different cases and situations, in these cases, it is sometimes the best route to go and just remove the tissue that is causing all of the pain and the problems. So hopefully this has been helpful to kind of gain some insight into, you know, what symptomology is with these two different conditions and what root causes are so that you can then better address symptomology moving forward.